Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
We're now going to take you to a place that may well be confronting for some. I understand that. It's a place where few of us have been, most would dread it, but we'll all end up there. It's that time where each of our lives comes to an end. And my next guest has a great deal of personal, powerful experience being alongside people at that very moment. And the surprising thing, he says, there are extraordinary gifts to be found here, and they should be shared, which we're going to do tonight on Open House in what I'm sure will be a compelling, if confronting, conversation. My guest is Dr. Michael Barbato, a man who's had a wealth of experience as a palliative care physician, and he's sharing some of those quite amazing end-of-life experiences tonight on Open House. And would also love to tap into your stories if you're up to it. And I hope you are. Are you one who has a story witnessing an end-of-life experience? After we chat with Michael, we'd be really glad to hear from you on 1300 40 2020 or post on our Open House Community Facebook page. Have you seen, heard or experienced firsthand as you've been alongside someone at the end of their lives? What was that like? 1300 40 2020 or post on our Open House Community Facebook page. Dr. Michael Barbato, welcome to Open House. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Lee, and thank you for inviting me to be on.
Pleasure. Michael, you'd understand, I'm sure, how this will be a confronting thing for many, taking us kind of into the ward where life is often coming to an end. It's one of the great taboos, isn't it?
It is, but let me say it's not just in the wards, but it's also at home.
Yes.
And even in the face of death, whether it's in home or hospital, people still find it very difficult to confront that reality because of the enormous fear and sadness that surrounds death and dying.
Yes. Michael, can I position you early in your career? You have the whole world of medicine before you. What directed you to palliative care, the care of the dying, and why did you go there?
Well, to be frank, it was the last place I wanted to find myself. In early on in my career, in fact, I was very much involved with saving lives. I was a specialist physician, and most of my work in rural country towns involved treating people with heart disease and quite often resuscitating them from serious events. But once confronted in the work of being a doctor with death and dying, and there were several experiences both in my professional life and in my personal life that made me think a lot about death, and it got to a point where I realised that firstly, I wasn't attending to people who were dying or their families as well as I felt I should, but there are also some experiences with people that I cared for who were dying that made me question what really goes on in the mind and the life of someone who's dying, and it reached a point where I felt I wanted to learn more about this and hopefully be able to attend better to these people. And ultimately, about 23 years ago, I left consultancy as a physician and moved into palliative care.
So it went beyond mere professional medical interest.
Yes, there was an attraction to it. That might sound unusual, but I did want to understand a little more about what happened around the time of death, not just to satisfy my curiosity, but I felt if I and others who worked in palliative care knew a little bit more about death and dying, we could actually be present and attend to these people a little better than perhaps we were doing so at that time.
Yes. While it is such a taboo subject, I'm sure we share that same kind of curiosity, morbid as it might seem to the outsider, but it is a most compelling place to be, I think inevitably because we'll all end up there.
Well, the famous quote of Woody Allen, no one gets out of this world alive. So it's going to happen to all of us, and the more preparation we do for it, well, I was going to say the less traumatic it will be. One can't guarantee that, of course, but it's like all things, the better one prepares for it, the more likely the journey will be less harrowing than it otherwise would be.
Yes. How long was it then in your work before you started to notice some of these, as I put it before, these end-of-life experiences?
Well, I suppose I in fact noticed them before I got into palliative care, and that was the turning point to make for me to enter into palliative care. There had been several people that I'd cared for that had experiences that I just couldn't explain in a rational way, and they really opened my mind to enormous possibilities. So when I entered into palliative care, I really took an interest in end-of-life care and the experiences people had at the end of their life. And they were frequent, not just occasional, and they are events that occur very commonly. And because of the enormous sadness that's associated with the death of someone we love, the experiences, which often are gifts in many ways, are overlooked, not only by the family who may be present by the bedside, but sadly often by the medical staff or the team that's caring for that person as they're dying.
Before I ask you to be more specific on what some of those experiences are, I'm curious in your description of them as gifts to be shared.
Well, they are. I put them as gifts, and I'm not the first one to have used that word, and I suspect for many of the listeners tuned into this program, they would find it an unusual way to describe an event. But often these events can change dramatically the state of mind and the spiritual well-being of someone who's dying, and we will often refer to them as healing experiences, experiences that can lead to a remarkable sense of peace and equanimity in the face of death, experience them, qualities that are often, one would imagine, not found, but can, in fact, occur, not only because of the way someone's treated, but because, or cared for, but also because of the nature of these experiences. It's been said that the goal of palliative care is, in fact, to promote healing in the face of death. And by healing, I'm referring to those qualities of peace and equanimity. In other words, to create conditions whereby they may occur. And that often involves a lot of hard work. But I've found that if people who are dying have one of these unusual experiences, that healing quality can dramatically appear in the face of what until then has been hardship and sadness.
Yes. So let me ask you this. What are some of those, as you say, consistent experiences that you started to notice?
Well, they can be either emotional or they can be spiritual. The emotional ones, the ones that are probably more common, are people who want to deal with unfinished business. In other words, to seek forgiveness for things they've done or haven't done in the past, and the transformation that can actually occur with that, with those type of events is remarkable. But the other ones are experiences which I often refer to as near-to-death experiences, experiences that we can't understand, but in themselves create a dramatic shift in the state of a person's well-being and can often lift that darkness that surrounds them and replace it with a certain amount of light. And those experiences may be visions of predeceased relatives.
That's quite a common one.
It's reported to occur in approximately 25% of people who are dying. But I believe that there's sometimes a dramatic sense of peace that can come without any associated vision. And I think if we rely just on people describing a vision, we may not see those near-to-death experiences or be aware of them so commonly. But if we just take notice of the approach or the attitude of people, we can see changes. And these changes, if they're not because of the so-called deathbed phenomenon, the visions that I've just described, can sometimes come through dreams, which can be remarkably healing in the face of death.
Yes.
One particular, if I'm allowed to talk about one of the dreams that a lady described to me, well, not actually to me, to one of her daughters. And this woman was not able to come to terms with the fact that she was dying, nor would she talk about it. And so there was a certain air of despair and depression around at the time, simply because there was no conversation taking place about death and dying, the type of conversations you and I would like to have with someone we love, the yes. things we want to say. But every time this woman's daughter attempted to tell her mother how much she'd meant to her throughout her life, the mother would just chop that conversation off because it was too difficult for her.
Yes.
This woman was ultimately admitted to a hospital because she was nearing death. But the other reason she was admitted is because her husband died suddenly several weeks before because of a heart attack. So this woman was not only facing her own grief and her own death, but was trying to come to terms, and she was grieving over the sudden death of her husband. And so that made the situation so much more difficult, and as you can imagine, the whole atmosphere surrounding her was clouded with sadness and enormous grief. And she just wouldn't open up. But then one day she said to her daughter, "I dreamt that Tony," the name of her husband, "will come tonight." And the daughter said, "And what are you going to do?" And she said, "I think we'll go dancing." Now, the important thing about that was she and her husband, Tony, used to go dancing every week of their married life. And that woman, from that point on, when she recounted her dream, there was a total change in her demeanour, and she was, from my point of view, healed, meaning there was that sense of peace and equanimity and calmness about it that wasn't there before. And the interesting thing is that woman died the next night. So she had a precognitive dream that she was dying, and these dreams are, like the deathbed visions, are often symbolic. And because they're symbolic, we often misinterpret them, and they're often labelled as part of a delirium or an hallucination secondary to medication. And not only are they therefore not recognised, but they're also medicated. And that's somewhat sad from an overall point of view.
It was an issue I wanted to ask you, because there would be those who'd perhaps quite understandably say, I think, well, surely this is the effect of drugs, because most of the time these poor souls are highly medicated for their pain as they are dying. What do you say to that?
Well, they're medicated. I would be the first to admit that 90% of people are on some form of medication, often morphine or a similar pain-relieving drug, before they die. But the number of times that you can attribute these hallucinations to medications such as morphine, very, very few.
Okay.
For the simple reason that hallucinations or delusions associated with morphine or drugs are quite bizarre, poorly formed, grotesque, whereas the visions people have, let me go back to the hallucinations, and they're also frightening, whereas the visions people have as part of a deathbed vision or part of a dream are very clear, the people in it are recognisable. There's, in 99% of cases, it's not fear that's associated with that vision or dream, but this overwhelming sense of peace and joy that can often see a transformation in their demeanour.
Can I read you one of the posts on our Open House community Facebook page in response to our interview?
Yes.
From Christine? She says, "When my mum and many others I've been present for their passing, I experienced them almost waking up with joy as they communicated to a spirit world," as she puts it, as they saw their loved ones who'd gone before them, saying with joy, "Hi, Mary. Yes, it is a lovely dress. Yes, I'm coming."
Yeah.
Then they would lie back and take their final breath, made saying goodbye and letting go much easier.
Well, in fact, this we're often taught, well, there's a lot of publicity, both in medical journals, not so much in the newspapers, about what is referred to as lightening up or awakening before death. And it's certainly been my experience, and obviously the experience of your listener there, of someone who shows a burst of activity, a burst of life just before death, And this is often associated with either a deathbed vision or an awareness that they're not dying, but it's a transition rather than a death.
I wanted to ask how much you thought where faith fits into these kind of experiences. Before I ask you that question, can I just get you to hold on there, Michael, and take a call from Elka from Campbelltown in Sydney. Hi, Elka.
Yes, hello, Lee.
Thanks very much for calling in.
Especially when you took over the realm. Very surprising.
You're very kind. Thanks so much.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to say about 15 years ago when I was doing my nurse's training, you get to see a lot of these near-death incidents, but one in particular that stood out, and I'll never forget, I almost think about every day, is I was doing my training and I got to know this patient. He was very ambulant, very coherent, always alert, and quite often I thought, why is he at this hospital? He had kidney problems, but anyway, I used to always make it a point to talk to him, and I got to know him and I thought, he was in his 80s, and I thought, I've really got to ask him about God and maybe talk to him if he doesn't know God. And I remember asking him, do you go to church? And he said, oh, Jesus is my best friend. And I thought, oh, that's it. I don't need to tell him anymore. You can't sort of say that unless you are a Christian. And then I remember a few weeks later, I'd always made a point to talk to him and got to know him. And I just remember thinking, he's the most humblest man I'd ever met. And one afternoon, just before I had my nurse's report, I thought I'd say hello to him. Came on about 2 o'clock. And I was talking to him just like I'm talking to you. And then he was sitting on his bed upright and he was looking to the right-hand side of his bed. I was standing on the left. And all of a sudden he said, look, Jesus is standing at the end of my bed with outstretched hands calling me home. And his chin just dropped and he went. He was gone. Like one second I was talking to him, the next he was gone. And immediately, I felt the presence of God. Immediately I thought, I've got to take my shoes off. This is holy ground. But I thought, I've got to report his death, you know?
Yes.
And, I'll just never forget it. And it just taught me a huge lesson that humility is really probably the most important trait that we have, that we're here to acquire while we're here on earth.
Too right.
And I remember the next morning I read the report and it sort of said death unknown cause. They didn't know why he died, but I knew.
Yes.
Yeah, so
the time had come.
Yeah, never forget that. It's always and it just taught me, I knew from then on there is life after death and God promises us what he says in the Word. He will take us home.
Okay, thanks so much for calling in tonight.
Thank you.
Michael, I was going to ask, have you thought much about where faith fits into this kind of experience?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer, but if I can, I'll address it this way, and I've alluded to it a little, that our task in palliative care is to try and promote healing in the face of death. And by healing, as I've described already, I mean that peace and equanimity around the time of death. And another description of the healing process is it's a form of illumination despite the darkness that surrounds death. Mm. Now, there are many things that contribute to this healing process, and just not in any particular order. It's the type of environment that we create around that person that's dying that can either be conducive or inhibit the healing process. And I think you can understand what I mean by that, where they're cared for and the amount of love that's in that room or in that home or in that hospital or palliative care ward. But the other things that can contribute to a peaceful death is the length of time a person has to prepare for their death. And unfortunately, in our medicalised world, that time seems to be getting shorter and shorter, and often it's not sufficient time for them to do all the necessary preparatory work for the healing process to occur. But despite that, we still do our best.
Yes.
But the other factors that are significantly important is the depth of faith someone has, their spiritual life, and the practices they've engaged in during their life. So faith and spiritual work are very significant, as far as I'm concerned, in creating or leading up to a healing experience around death. And whether that comes because of an experience such as we've talked about and heard about, or whether it occurs de novo because of that individual and the way they've prepared for their death in both a psychological and a spiritual way, it's very hard to say.
Yes. I wanted to ask you this question finally. or make this point, it is also important, I wonder whether you would agree, to acknowledge the great loss involved at this time. The Bible calls it the great sting of death. This is not a thing that can be glossed up. We are meant, I guess, to feel, I'm sure, to feel the grief and the pain of it.
Absolutely. Even though I talk about peace and equanimity, that doesn't get rid of the sadness. The sadness is there irrespective of what else is happening. And the sadness is there simply because of the love that's present between the people concerned. And it's well known, the greater the love, the greater the sadness and the grief. But I think with that healing experience, my belief is that grief can be appeased somewhat. There will always be grief. But if those final days, hours, minutes, seconds of life are done well, and particularly if there's some healing experience such as the one Ilka described or some of the ones that I've witnessed over my 20-plus years in palliative care, that is not only healing for the person that dies, but does have a healing effect on the people who are left behind.
Yes.
It doesn't get rid of the grief, doesn't get rid of the sadness, but it does make an enormous difference.
Dr. Michael Barbato, I'm so grateful for you joining us tonight. Thank you so much indeed for sharing these experiences, these amazing experiences with our open house audience across Australia.
Pleasure, Lee.
Okay.
Thank you.
As I said before, I well realise this can be a really delicate and difficult question to throw open, but if you feel like sharing your experiences, we'd love to hear them tonight on Open House. Again, it's a time and place few of us will ever get to be for most of our lives. I know firsthand how terribly confronting and difficult this is, but if you've been there for some of this, these end-of-life experiences, we'd be really interested to hear of them. Give us a call on 1300 40 20 20 or post on our Open House community Facebook page. Very often, as we've already seen, these end-of-life experiences and the lead-up to them are defining times in a person's life when they are confronted, perhaps for the first time seriously, about questions of faith and eternity. In fact, we had a classic story of that happening just a couple of weeks ago on Open House from James, whose father had fought in World War II. He'd been a prisoner of war in Changi. Here's what James told us about his dad and what happened on the last day of his life.
He did things as a prisoner that he felt unforgivable for. He knew about Jesus. He'd grown up in Sunday school. But Dad saw things that he couldn't believe that a God would allow, and he did things that he felt the same God could not forgive him for. Hmm. And he held on to those things for pretty well the rest of his life, and people prayed for him for all the way through from the war till the day he died, and an army chaplain actually sat with him on the morning that he died, and he just asked Dad, who's a soldier's best friend, and Dad gave that answer, Jesus, and Jim Doust, who was that army chaplain, a friend of mine, just led Dad through the next half an hour where Dad handed his life over to Jesus. And I saw Dad 2 hours later and he was already dying. So that was the last conversation that he had. And I didn't know that he'd become a Christian. And I, as he was dying, I read to him Psalm 139, which has ever since been very powerful for me. Mm. And to know that Dad will be in heaven is such an exciting prospect for me, because I know that I wasn't confident about that before that day.
It's James from a couple of weeks ago. What a wonderful and comforting story a couple of weeks ago. Vanjie has been listening in Newcastle. Hi, Vanjie.
Hello, how are you?
Thanks for joining us on Open House. What's your story?
Yeah, I'd like to share a story about my father. I actually lost him to cancer 5 years ago. And Dad had been quite unwell with numerous things. He was mentally ill. He had glaucoma. He had diabetes. And he'd lived a really troubled life, I guess. And we had a couple of weeks to prepare. It was obvious that he wasn't going to get well. And I remember even just for myself praying and saying, God, I just absolutely believe that you can heal him of all of these things. But if it's time to take him home, I actually prayed that it wouldn't drag on and on because of particularly the mental illness. And I know you've talked a bit tonight about people feeling that incredible peace, and that was definitely true of our situation. And rather than this, I guess, making Dad suffer more mentally. I actually saw him the most peaceful, the most calm that I'd probably ever seen him in his whole life. And he just really prayed and asked God that he would help him to face whatever he needed to. And so certainly as we were in those last days with all the family gathered around, that was just so tangible, the peace, the supernatural presence of God that was in that hospital room. And something remarkable happened. The doctors and nurses were preparing us for the horrible ways that it could end, and it just couldn't have been a more peaceful and wonderful time for our family, which amazed me. It just totally amazed me. And as Dad was taking his last breaths, the whole family were around him. We were just sort of holding him and smiling and just having the most wonderful time with God. And my brother, who doesn't normally say very much, all of a sudden burst out these words, and he said, the angels are coming, Dad, it's okay, it's nearly time. And he kind of just walked my dad through, even though Dad was unconscious at this time, he just was speaking these words. And I'm looking around the room thinking, are we about to see an angel? Like, oh my goodness, what's happening here?
Yes.
And later on, I asked my brother, I said, what was going on there? And he said, I didn't see anything, but these words just bubbled out of my mouth. I felt compelled to say them, and he had no control over it. And yeah, I look back at that time, and I know it sounds really strange, and maybe some other people can identify with this, but it really felt like the most beautiful time our family had ever had together. And as Dad went into the next life, so yeah, amazing sense of peace and presence of God in that time.
Makes me understand what Michael was saying about these experiences actually being a gift that we should share.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree.
Vanjie, thanks so much for sharing that with us tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you. Neil has called in from Melbourne. Hi, Neil.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, thanks, Neil. What's your story?
My story is very similar to the woman that just spoke there. I actually have a mental illness, and I had one recurring over many, many years. And I actually had a bad upbringing where, you know, I sort of took drugs when I was a younger teenager, and then I got severely interfered with. But anyway, briefly, if I may,
yeah.
I had several attempts of suicide, and I actually 13 times of suicide. The last time was when my daughter was born, Courtney, which, yeah, but anyway, and I ended up suiciding, and I got taken up through a black, sort of a grey light, a black, grey, and then into a tunnel.
Okay.
And shot up into this tunnel, and there was a round light there, and I'll never forget it. Never, ever in my life will I ever forget it. And it stopped me from suiciding ever since. I'm still got a mental illness, but it was profound. I mean, utterly profound, to the point of where I was just devastated by the light behind that I could see in this big round hole. And it was a beautiful, beautiful big round light. It was magnificent. And then appeared what looked like an angel or this figure in front of me, and he said thought to me. He said, look, you know, like, there's much for you to do, Neil. Now go back. And like, I'm wrestling, this is only thought, and I believe it's a thought world up there. You see, it's visionary and thought. And anyway, he said to me, that this man, he said, Neil, from thought to thought only. And he said, it's not your time. Now go back. And I questioned him, and I said, why? Why do I have to go back? I like what I see there. It's beautiful. It's peaceful. There's little beautiful pastel lights, and it's beautiful. It's gorgeous. And he tapped his foot and pointed his finger just ever so gently and said to me, Neil, it's time for you to go. Now go back. I said, well, I don't want to. I'm home now. If you let me go, I'm home. And he said, no, go back. And I came back. I was, you know, I could call it a delusion if you want to, but I know what I felt and saw. And I came back, and that was phenomenal. And I could see, even though I've got a mental illness, I could see through people, and I could see where their hurt was and where their pain was. And I came back ever so sensitive, more so, but I was free of a lot more of my pain inside my whole self, and yeah. It was incredible.
What a powerful, life-transforming experience. Neil, thanks very much for calling in tonight. Andrew has also called in. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Lee. How are you? please?
Yeah, fine, thanks. What's your story?
My story is last year I was listening to your program when Sheridan had it, obviously, and there was a lady, Trudy Harris, who was a hospice nurse. And just at that time, she was talking about her experiences with people dying. And my dad had just been diagnosed with cancer, and I was thinking, you know, how are we going to face all this and whatever? And then, so listening to her stories, and then like your guest just said there, Michael, when I was called over to be with him, and it was just the most incredible experience, you know. And like he said, although it was really sad, it was such a gift that I'd never, you know, want to trade for anything. You know, he was, we were with him, and then he said my mum had passed away about 18 months beforehand, and he just, you know, this was a man who was highly dosed on morphine, and he sat bolt upright in bed like he was going to launch out and walk, and he said to me, I've just been to heaven, I've seen Jesus, but I couldn't see mum, and they've sent me back. And then he lay down, and I just said, you know, just keep calm, Dad, everything in its time. And then he started talking about the angels. He's like, look at the beautiful angels up there. And then he was talking about listening to the music. He said, isn't that music beautiful? Wow. And, you know, we could not hear anything. And it was just, like he said, you know, although it was a sad time, he was actually passing on to his next journey. It was just an incredible gift. And my cousin who was with me, who was not really a great believer, you know, because he would, at that time there were there was an industrial chaplain who would pop in, and he'd just read verses from the Bible, and it was like, my God, somebody, you know, God has sent this man just at this time to read this verse in the Bible just to help us through.
What a powerful and undeniably real kind of experience. Andrew, thanks so much for sharing it with us tonight. Thank you. I should also let you know of a remarkable story and interview we're going to be bringing you next week on Open House, and it's somewhat in this vein of end-of-life experiences. It's the story of a four-year-old boy, very seriously ill and spiralling over 5 days. And with the benefit of hindsight, it appears he dies on the operating table and yet lives, and much to his parents' shock, sometime later, starts recounting his experience of going to heaven. His dad is Todd Burpo. Todd has written of young Colton's mind-blowing experience in his book, Heaven is for Real. The book has sold millions around the world. And we've just recorded an interview with Todd for next week's Open House. Here's a bit of it, where Colton, young four-year-old, sends his parents absolutely reeling.
I remember he came to us one day in the front room, and he walks up to his mom, and he actually kind of skipped into the room, and he walked up to his mom and said, Mom, I have two sisters. And she's like, what do you mean? Are you talking about your friend, your cousin? We knew about his older sister, but we didn't know what he was trying to say to us.
I was just going to clarify, he's already got Cassie, the older sister.
Yeah. And he's saying, I have two sisters. And Mom leans forward and says, what do you mean? And he goes, well, you had a baby die in your tummy, didn't you, Mom? And all of a sudden, you talked about time stopping. I mean, all of a sudden, we were both just didn't know where he was going. In between him and Cassie, we had a miscarriage. My wife was only 2 months along. And a few months later, Sonia conceived again, and then we were blessed with Colton. And we tried to kind of move on, if you will, you know. We replaced our hurt with the joy of parenting again and focused on being parents. And I don't know how you tell a three-year-old that babies die in their mommy's tummies without scaring them to death. You know, we had not brought that up to him. We had not shared that in front of him. And when he said that she'd had a baby die in her tummy, my wife's first response was, who told you? And his answer, well, she did. She told me she died in your tummy, Mom. He went to walk away, and then Mom just exploded. I remember her standing up, Colton, Todd Burpo, you get back here right now. You don't tell me something like that and walk away. Now, that was about many decibels louder than what I just shared that with you, of course.
Sure,
you know,
yes.
I remember my son looking at me like, Dad, help, and I'm like, you are so on your own.
That's Todd Burpo. You must not miss that interview next week on Open House, you may well be sceptical. I think I can understand that. You may think it's totally freaky, but wait until you hear the kinds of things that young Colton brought back from. Yes, the claim is heaven. That's next week. Tay has stopped at a public phone box and rung us tonight on Open House. Thanks very much for calling in, Tay. Hi.
Thank you. Hi.
Appreciate it.
I was just listening to your program and I feel I wanted to share. I've never told anyone in my family. My father passed away about 3 years ago. And when he was in the hospital, I went to visit him and he said to me, oh, this lady came to visit me and she said to me, I want to pray with you. And then he prayed with her and then she said to him, I just want to say to you, I walked through this hallway and thank you, your door was the only door that I found open. So after their prayer, she left and of course I came in to visit, but he called the nurse and said, he said, the lady who comes here from the church, and the nurse said, the lady hasn't come yet and it's not a lady, it's the ministers that come. I didn't see anyone. At that moment, I thought, oh my God, he's going to leave me. But he came out of hospital, but he wanted to go home and see our family at home. But he passed when he was coming back. That was like, it took 2 weeks.
Wow.
But I was scared to death when he told me that I felt he found his peace and he was going to leave me. And sure enough, 2 weeks later, he left me on the way back home here on the plane. I just wanted to share that I've never even told my family what he told me that day. It was like he told me it was time for him to go.
Yes. So I'm so glad that you've shared that with us tonight.
Thank you for letting me.
I feel the weight of the privilege. Thank you so much for calling in.
Okay, bye.
Okay. We've had so much response to the end-of-life experiences from Dr. Michael Barbito. Diane from Kellyville in Sydney has rung in. Hi, Diane.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Thanks for calling. What's your story?
So my dad had a stroke at 51 and my mum looked after him at home for 33 years. And not long before he died, mum called all the family home and my sister was already there and I was in Sydney and I drove up the night before, and by the time I'd got there, Dad had already been put on like the morphine drip.
Okay.
And so he was incoherent, but as I was walking past his bedroom, he sort of stirred, and I said to Mum, "Oh, Dad's stirring." So everyone went into the room, and I'd written down all these notes, but I'm not even reading them. I'm just sort of talking from memory.
Always the best way.
Yeah, and so we went into the room, and we were just all there. And I mean, Mum had said like lots of prayers, you know, before I'd got there over the, you know, the last few weeks and that, but I'd actually gone and said the sinner's prayer with him like 2 weeks before he passed. And so anyway, not long before he died that night, because he'd been on the morphine, he was like, you know, unconscious. But just before he passed, he opened his eyes wide open, looked up almost to the roof, to the right of the room, and he was like wide awake, saw something, like he recognized someone, and then just closed his eyes and died. And we were all around, and no one sort of cried or anything, because I actually just sort of said to myself, well, have a good trip, Dad. And I thought, wow, this is great. You know, I thought, well, actually his suffering's over and he's gone home to a better place. And
yes,
instead of us all being crying and upset, we were all like, well, this is good. And we actually all went out and had a glass of wine.
So as you reflect back on it, what's the experience left you like?
Well, I was actually really happy when he passed, because he'd been suffering for such a long time with the stroke. And, you know,
yes,
he died when he was like 80, 83, and everything was just starting to fall apart. And, you know, the quality of life wasn't so good, even though Mum was looking after him, you know, and I think it was getting a bit hard for her too, because she'd been looking after him all that time. And I thought, the experience is just, you just got to have Jesus in your life. And, you know, all my family is Catholic, I still went and said the sinner's prayer with him. But and I mean, you know, everyone's always believed in Jesus, and but they hadn't really said the sinner's prayer, so I just went in and said it with him one time just by myself. And I went in and I said to Dad, you know, I'm going to say the prayer with you. And then because he couldn't talk, I said, do you agree? And he goes, yes.
Mm.
And I just walked out of the room and I go, yes!
Diane, thank you so much for calling in tonight. It's been a great story.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
It's been quite an experience to hear all these stories tonight.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology Solutions. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.